I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. It's been more than 6 months since an unshaven Saddam Hussein was dragged from his spider hole. Today he appeared in an Iraqi court as a criminal to answer to charges of genocide and war crimes. I am Saddam Hussein, he told the court, the president of Iraq. He refused to sign a list of charges and maintained a defiant stand in front of the judge, as evidenced in this translation from CNN.
How can you charge me with anything without protecting my rights under the Constitution? This is not right.
Saddam Hussein appeared in court along with 11 of his senior Ba'ath Party henchmen, but it will likely be months before any of their trials are underway. Although there are many good political reasons to rush along the tribunals, there are many legal reasons to delay. Will the judges be fair? Will people even agree to testify against the Ba'ath Party leaders? Will the trials themselves have credibility in and outside Iraq? These are among the many questions being debated in legal circles today. And today we'd like to hear from you. Can Saddam Hussein get a fair trial? And after all he did to his country, does that matter? How important is the prosecution of these leaders in helping Iraq get back on its feet? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Now, we've got a number of people we'll be hearing from today. First, we're going to Thanasi Kambanis. He is a correspondent for the Boston Globe. He's based in Iraq, and at this moment he's at the convention center in Baghdad. I understand, Thanasi, that's some distance away from the place where Saddam Hussein is actually appearing before the judge.
Yes, Saddam Hussein appeared in a small courtroom in Camp Victory, which is the name for the sprawling U.S. camp at the edge of the Baghdad International Airport. That's several miles from the edge of the city. Today's proceedings went on shrouded in great secrecy and with very little access. There were actually only a dozen seats in the courtroom for spectators, and that included a very small media pool, representatives of the prime minister, the head of the special tribunal, and the new national security advisor to the Iraqi government.
It sounds a little bit like an indication that those sorts of security concerns are going to make it difficult to have much of this held in public at all.
Well, again, this is an instance where you would expect either the new government or the American stage managers of this event to have created somewhat of a more powerful image than they did. There was no live television footage of Saddam being walked into the courtroom, nor was there any live footage of the proceedings. These images that you're probably seeing by this time of day on the east coast of the United States have trickled out as pool footage hours after the event. Out on the streets of Baghdad, in fact, people were unaware initially that Saddam was before the judge until hours later when the Arab satellite stations first started reporting it. And it does undercut a little bit of the oomph that one expected from hauling this once all-powerful tyrant up before a judge who looks to be about half his age.
How did he look? Tell me more.
Well, he looked very different than he looked pre-war, and although he was a cleaned-up version of the man who walked out of the foxhole in December, he looked more like that man than he did like the dictator of Iraq. Instead of the trademark mustache, he kept the full-face beard, which was a sort of salt-and-pepper gray. His hair was longer, and although it was coiffed, it still looked bushy and a little bit unkempt. He was wearing a regular suit and a white shirt without a tie. According to a U.S. officer who helped manage the proceeding today, it was a shirt bought off the rack at a Baghdad department store. Now, Saddam was a man accustomed to either wearing his military uniform or wearing $2,000 hand-stitched Italian suits. So to be wearing a shabby gray and white pinstripe suit that was not fitted to his shoulders must have been a bit of a come down for him.
Thanasi, he said to the judge, based on the translation that I was able to see, that he wouldn't even sign the list of charges he was presented with, that he would come back and do that with his lawyer. Does that mean that Saddam Hussein will be back in this courtroom at some point soon? Or what do you think?
He will be back sometime soon. We still don't know when, although I expect by the end of the day we will, when we get a complete transcript. He will be back to either plead guilty or not guilty, or perhaps we're getting a sense of the legal strategy he's going to follow, which might be to refuse to acknowledge the court at all. Now, as far as the charges read against him today, he did engage the judge. And there were, if you watch the full tape, which was about a half an hour proceeding, there were times that he seemed sort of weak and sunken, bags under his eyes and passive. But then there were other times where he rose up and you'll see him gesticulating and waving his pen and pointing at the judge. And apparently they had a couple of pointed exchanges, the most intensive of which was after the judge read the 7 tentative charges against him, ranging from the gassing of the Kurds in Halabja to the Anfal campaign. The last charge was for the invasion of Kuwait and war crimes committed there. At that point, apparently Saddam said, how can you as an Iraqi, or what's this effect, how can you as an Iraqi charge me with that when you know that Kuwait was part of Iraq? And then he proceeded to start a strange rant, saying that the dogs in Kuwait were trying to turn our women into 10 dinar prostitutes, at which point the judge cut him off. And I think this is something that court observers have been looking for. Will Saddam follow in the footsteps of Milosevic and try and turn this war crimes court into a place for him to grandstand? The judge cut him off in less than a minute, stopped him and said, you know, this language is completely inappropriate, and moved the proceedings forward.
All right, Tanasi, thanks for your insight on this. We'll talk again.
Thanks. Take care, Dick.
Thanasi Kambanis is a correspondent for the Boston Globe based in Baghdad. We want to hear how this is being regarded by Iraqis living in Baghdad. And for that, Imad is now joining us on the line from the capital city of Iraq. He's asked that we not use his last name because of security concerns that are so much a part of everybody's daily life in Iraq. But Imad, it's good of you to be with us. How are you?
I'm all right. Thank you, Dave.
I gather that you were not able to see much or any of this on any of the television stations, Arabic or otherwise, in Baghdad.
Well, we did see it about half an hour ago. They showed us some part of the court of the trial, but with the voices, it was almost blocked. Only for 5 minutes, we heard about part of it for about 5 to 10 minutes. Instead of the whole trial, which lasted, as we told, for about half an hour.
Imad, you're one of these people who stayed in Iraq through all those years of the Ba'ath Party rule. I'm curious to know what was inside your heart as you were watching that man appear in an Iraqi court answering to those charges.
Yes. Well, on behalf of the Iraqis, I think the majority of the Iraqis are so delighted and glad today to see what's happening. But after all, what happened today was just, I think, a transmission of Saddam from the custody of the coalition forces to the custody of the Iraqis. But overall thing, it's something to be pleased for, because Iraq ruled, because Saddam ruled the Iraqis, with the So in a very harsh way, and he was a real tyrant, he just disignored them in every respect. So it is a day, it's a real good day to see Saddam in this situation.
Do you trust this tribunal to get at the truth of Saddam's years in power?
This is, I thank you. I thank you very much for this question, because I think this trial is not really legitimate, because the court usually derives its legitimacy from the government. Now, we have the government. It's not legitimate yet, because it's not been, this government has been elected from the Iraqi people. So I think if they wait for the actual trial, for a fair trial, until the government is elected by the Iraqi people.
Your view then would be to leave. Sorry, go ahead, Imad.
Yeah, the other thing is we wait. Actually, we want not only Saddam Hussein to be on trial. We want all the people on a fair trial to all Iraqis who played a dirty game and harmed the Iraqis for the last 40 years, even those who are in power right now. We want a fair trial for all of them, because we keep hearing rumors and things that some of the men now in power, they did the same. They sent some bombing cars in the 70s or in the 80s. So we want to open the verdict widely in front of all the world and to have a fair trial for that.
Imad, thanks a lot for being with us on the program.
You're welcome, Dave. Thank you.
Thank you, and take care of yourself. That's Imad joining us on the phone there, live from Baghdad. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We're taking our first look at the appearance of Saddam Hussein before the Iraqi Special Tribunal, which began this morning, our time, this afternoon, in Baghdad. A very defiant former Iraqi president, clearly not about to answer the charges that are before him. And so that's posing a number of political and legal questions, which we'll be digging into as we go through this hour. I want to introduce a guest who's going to be with us for the balance of the hour. Neil Kritz is director of the Rule of Law Program at the United States Institute of Peace, and he's joining us from NPR's Washington studios. Hello, Neil.
Good morning, Dick. Glad to be here.
You had a chance to listen to the suspicion that Imad expressed there, and I guess that's something that you knew would be there all along. Am I right?
Well, it will be there among some people. There are others, though, who obviously the Iraqis have a tremendous challenge now, because on the one hand, there are those who will say, well, we need to wait until after elections, an appointment of a new court, etc. And there are others who will say we need to have this trial tomorrow. The challenge is to strike the balance and ensure that there's a process that does the best job possible under the circumstances of proceeding in a way that's viewed as credible and legitimate and satisfying the needs of the Iraqi people.
But if I can just get you in a few seconds to help me with this, because we're coming to a break. There's so many questions that the tribunal's to answer. It is its credibility in international eyes, its credibility in the eyes of Iraqis, and its legal viability. Is it, in fact, handing out justice to these people?
The short answer is that no one will be able to answer that question for many months. But as they're moving forward, they need to be doing this in a way that accomplishes all of those. And I think that they are proceeding along those lines. This is going to be a hard, long process. There's not going to be a trial tomorrow. They're going to be building this institution. They're going to be developing the rules, ensuring, hopefully, that this will be a transparent process. And a process that affords due process. They have built into the system series of provisions for international participation in this process to ensure that this tribunal does satisfy international standards. And all this is going to be a work in progress in the months to come.
1-800-423-8255. That's the number to join our conversation on this day when Saddam Hussein appears before an Iraqi judge and has his first opportunity to answer to charges of crimes against humanity, war crimes, as well as charges of genocide. Is this going to be a tribunal that will be fair? And is this a tribunal that will be seen to be fair, not only by people living outside Iraq, but by people in that country? To what extent is it a part of Iraq getting itself back on its feet as a nation? 1-800-423-TALKS, the number to join us. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio, and the Iraqi Special Tribunal's work is now officially underway in Baghdad with the appearance of Saddam Hussein and 11 of his senior Ba'ath Party officials before an Iraqi judge answering to an array of charges. The beginning of a very long process, we should point out. So we're taking this opportunity to talk about what's ahead and where the credibility problems will be, where the the international influence can be of assistance and also be troublesome. Our number, so you can join us, 1-800-423-TALK. Neil Kritz is with us. He's director of the Rule of Law Program, the United States Institute of Peace. He's also editor of a three-volume work called Transitional Justice, which is what we're talking about here, How Emerging Democracies Reckon with Former Regimes. We're also going to bring onto the program now Hani Magali. He's director of the Middle East Program at the International Center for Transitional Justice. Hello, Hani.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for being with us. I wanted to talk to you today because I read a couple of your comments yesterday where you're saying that there are some serious questions about the process, about U.S. funding of the courts and the investigation and search for evidence and all that sort of. What are the problems associated with that?
Well, first let me say that, this is a very significant moment for the victims and relatives of victims in Iraq. It's very good that there's going to be a trial. Saddam Hussein, Kamikal Ali, and others should be held to account for the horrific violations that took place over the last few decades in Iraq. It's also very good that they're going to be charged with the most serious crimes, war crimes, crimes against humanity, genocide. I think that's right for the victims and for the country. And it's also good that this will happen in Iraq, in Arabic, will involve Iraqi judges, will be accessible to the victims. So the question marks that come up are more to do with, is this going to be a fair, independent, impartial process that respects the rights of the defendants? Because it's very important, I think, for Iraqis, for the region as a whole, and internationally, that this is seen to be a trial that's above reproach. And the questions that come up are really to do, one, with the capacity of the Iraqi judges, prosecutors, investigators, to really mount such a process, given that they've gone through 30, 40 years of total undermining of the judiciary, corruption, a second system that was established by Saddam Hussein of military trials, special courts, special tribunals, etc.
You heard Imad speaking just a couple of moments ago, though, about the suspicions of whether or not the tribunal will be the judgment of the tribunal will be respected if it's done at this time under an interim government. Are you saying that it would be better to just keep these people under lock and key, wait for an elected government to be in place, and then go ahead with the trials?
I mean, I think to do the actual investigation, to gather the evidence, to mount a proper trial, it will take months anyway. So it's unlikely, and I think the director of the tribunal has already said it's unlikely the court will actually begin before the end of the year or early next year. So that may not be an issue to look at, because in fact I think it's unlikely the trial, if they follow the process that they should, would happen before next year. But on the other hand, I think the question about who is in charge and who is behind them has been raised quite a number of times within Iraq, because what they've seen are people who have been appointed, but then the United States has very much played the role behind the scenes of training the people, funding the tribunal to the tune of $75 million, conducting the investigations, developing the prosecution strategy, developing the policy and the charges. And then people ask the question, well, who's really in charge of this? Is this really going to be independent? And even though a lot of this stuff has been done for good reasons, you know, to assist the Iraqis in mounting this process, it would have been far better to have made this a much more internationalized process than to have it be seen.
I mean, similar to the UN involvement.
Dominated by the U.S.
Excuse me, similar to the UN involvement in the criminal tribunal for Yugoslavia, for East Timor, for Sierra Leone, places like that.
Well, I think it's right that Iraqis are involved and take the lead in dealing with this. But I think a greater involvement from international experts with experience would help. It's still not too late to do that. The statute has opened the door to allow international advisors to come in. It would be good if they could have a bit more status, or if that could be clarified a little bit more
Let me, if I can, honey, go back to Neil Kritz on this, because to me it's key in understanding where the credibility of the tribunal will be challenged. Neil, it was, or I understand it was in the interest of the United States to prevent the international involvement, that for political reasons the U.S. wanted Iraqis to be in control of this because of that, the big push here in this country to demonstrate a shift from American control to Iraqi control. Have I got that right? Neil, are you there? Oh, we seem to have lost our connection with NPR's Washington studio. We'll get back to that. But, honey, this is something that I know that you've thought about as well. Maybe you can pitch in for Neil while we reestablish that connection.
Well, I think initially the whole sort of Iraq project was very much dominated by the U.S., the coalition, U.S. and Great Britain. And as a result, I think over the last year, it's now opening up a little bit more, but over the last year, it's been very much the United States and its partner, the United Kingdom, who have been providing all the assistance, taking all the decisions, dealing with the Iraqis, and being a funnel for anything that comes from outside the country. And many international experts have felt they did not want to be working through an occupation authority to assist the Iraqis. This may now change with the handover. There may be the ability now to deal directly with the Iraqis and not through the occupation authority. And this may now be an opportunity to go back and examine the statute of the court, to look at the rules of evidence and procedures, and to bring much more independent expertise, perceived to be independent expertise, because I think perception is very important here. Many in Iraq and in the region see this as a project that's controlled and dominated by the United States. And this is really unfair to the victims, to Iraqis themselves, to this very significant process that's about to take place in the country.
Okay, honey, let's take our first call now from Westwood, Massachusetts. Phil's joining us on the line. Hello, Phil. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking the call. Apropos of what you're discussing, I don't know. I think everybody that saw the footage that was played really last night for the first time, but then repeated again this morning on television of this courtroom. And the reference on CBS last night was that the pictures were taken yesterday in this courtroom before, any action was happened there. Had the American flag, only the American flag, in the courtroom. And the cameraman obviously was aware of the significance because he focused on that flag for a certain part of the clip, but none of the commentators, none of the reporters, acknowledged that reality. And
I should just clarify, Phil, for our listeners, that there were in fact two different appearances. The footage that we were watching last night was in fact from yesterday when control was handed over, but the footage that we're seeing this morning is relatively new. That's the appearance of those 12. I know that doesn't change the central point that you're making.
The point is that the American flag has no business in there at all if it's an Iraqi courtroom. They apparently went to some lengths to dress everybody in civilian clothes and all the rest of it to avoid military uniforms and so on, but here is this American flag sitting behind the judge, and no, obvious evidence of the Iraqi flag, which apparently nobody seems to like, that we created as well.
So you're saying that if you're watching this and you're paying attention to this, how is it going to be seen by people in Baghdad?
Exactly. I mean, I can't imagine how anybody would look at that and not, conclude that he's been brought into an American court.
All right, let's
is the American flag in that position? That's the question.
Neil Kritz is back with us now from our NPR studios in Washington. Neil, you're there, are you not?
Yes, I am back in now.
Did you have a chance to listen to Phil's observation of what he saw on television? Why that American flag might appear in a court that's supposed to be an Iraqi court? That's for you, Neil. Are you there? No, we're having some real difficulty with that connection to Washington.
Please.
I'm again going to lean on Hani here. I guess, Hani, this is a part of what needs to be avoided in many ways. Right?
Yes, exactly. I mean, I think these are more genuine mistakes than anything else, and people are just not sensitive enough or aware to be saying, look, this is something that has to be seen to be above reproach, completely independent. It can't in any way smack of Victor's justice. You know, the U.S. really should be very aware that for this to succeed, to get the backing of the majority of the population in the country throughout the Middle East region and internationally, the more that this can be turned into a process that's supported internationally as opposed to supported by the U.S., the better all around and for the future of, you know, respect for rule of law in Iraq and human rights.
Let's go next to West Point, New York. Mike's joining us on the line from there. Hello, Mike.
Hi, hello.
Fine. Thanks for calling. What are you thinking?
Well, I just had a question, essentially a takeoff on what was just stated, that the more international this process becomes, automatically the perception is the more legitimate. I just had a question. Seems to me that one of the key things that you sacrifice by mandating international participation and international support from Europe is the imposition of the death penalty at all. You forfeit that possibility. It seems to me that would make it less legitimate in the eyes of the Iraqis and take away a key punishment that is built into the fabric of Iraqi criminal law, and thereby make the whole process less legitimate in the eyes of the Iraqis. And I just wondered what their perception of that would be.
No, it's a really good question, because my understanding, honey, is that the when Paul Bremer was the man in charge of Iraq, he did away with the death penalty. He got rid of that law, but that there have since been public opinion polls in Iraq asking people there if they would like the death penalty back, and people are saying, yes, we do want the death penalty back. So there you are, caught in that, you know, if we go international, we lose access to that, but if we keep it as an Iraqi piece of justice alone, then the death penalty remains a part of it. How do you resolve those?
Sure. I mean, the death penalty issue is obviously a difficult one. You know, Iraqis are used to the death penalty being meted out against political opponents, you know, through the decades. And they see it as the ultimate punishment for the, you know, for the worst crimes. And so, you know, naturally they're thinking if Saddam and others are going to be tried, then they should get the worst punishment. At the same time, you know, this is a historic moment for Iraq. And, you know, it's a complete change from the past. They're introducing new laws. They're reforming institutions. And this would be a time really for an informed discussion and debate within the country about, you know, where do we want to go moving forward? And one of the issues is, do we want to have punishments such as used to occur under Saddam Hussein and his regime? You know, the death penalty being the worst form, in a sense, of cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment. Now, if you ask people today, of course, I think the majority will say, yes, yes, we want the death penalty. We want these people punished. But if there's an effort to start a discussion to explain to people where the trend has been going internationally on the death penalty, to explain what this means for the future, etc., I think you will see people will begin to think, well, do we really want to be repeating the past? Isn't this a moment to make a change for the future?
Mike, are you still there in West Point?
Yes.
Tell me what you're thinking about this. Is this something where, you know, either the international, those who are involved internationally, or even Americans with attitudes about it, need to just back right off and say, okay, Iraq, you make the call? Or should there be these other considerations that Hani's listing for us?
But I think it's actually the other way around, that the international community, at least on the issue of the death penalty, would be unwilling to allow the Iraqis to make the call.
The
price of international support would be to say, you cannot impose that because it's deemed illegitimate, not in the eyes of the Iraqis after a thoughtful discussion, but by the rest of the international community. To me, that's sort of a form of legal colonialism. And I would dispute the I think it's an inaccurate characterization to say that simply because you impose the death penalty, it's as was just said, exactly the same thing that used to happen under Saddam. The difference is, in a rebuilt Iraq based on the rule of law, you've got standards of justice being imposed and criminal procedures that are imposed, and I think that's a huge step forward for Iraq, both in the eyes of the domestic rule of law and in the eyes of the international community.
Okay, Mike, thanks a lot for your call.
Thank you.
1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK as we discuss the appearance this morning of Saddam Hussein in front of the Iraqi Special Tribunal. A reminder that we are reestablishing contact with Neil Kritz, who's trying to be with us from a Washington studio, and the, the technical gremlins are against him, but I think we're going to get him on the phone and get him back into the program in fairly short order. Next call to Raleigh, North Carolina. Rami's joining us. Hello, Rami.
Hello.
Thanks for calling. What are you thinking?
Well, I just had a question. It seems to me that the interim government right now has a lot bigger issues to deal with, and how much the Bush administration has to do with pushing for Saddam to be prosecuted. It seems like just a re-election campaign for Bush that, you know, he's the person that has the most to benefit out of this.
Okay, but flip it around, though, Rami. When you listen to what Iyad Alawi and the other members of the interim Iraqi government are presenting over the past few days since they got this handover of sovereignty, they've been looking for any opportunity sort of to demonstrate not only to Iraqis but to people outside the country that, yes, in fact, we are in control of the country. We can make these decisions. And I've been watching this tribunal as maybe one of the places where they can take that kind of a stand. Do you not see it that way?
I see your point as far as them them showing that they have control. I just see this as the American government right now having the most to gain by showing that this is getting resolved. I don't see this as a pressing issue for Iraq at the moment, and I see that they would have a lot more to gain if they rebuilt the country and then prosecuted. It would be a lot more legitimate. And I was just wondering, Hani put a little bit on the issue of, you know, American involvement in it, and I just see that. I think there's a lot bigger of an American push to get this out of the way.
There is, in fact, honey, a whole lot behind the curtain when you start to examine exactly what's going on here. I mean, the transfer of legal custody of Saddam Hussein and his Ba'ath Party officials to Iraq at the same time as they're still being held by the U.S. military in facilities guarded by the U.S. does raise questions about who's really in control, doesn't it?
Yes, I mean, at the same time, obviously, the security of these people is important if they're going to survive and appear in court. And, you know, there are genuine concerns about what would happen if they were just handed over, either, you know, for those who would like to see them, you know, executed tomorrow without a trial, or those who would like to free them and have them, you know, lead an insurrection. I think, though, it is important to recognize that obviously the real priority at the moment for Iraqis is security, electricity, employment, you know, getting their children back to schools, etc. And
I need to stop you there, honey, because we're going to take a short break. But as you point out, what those principal concerns are for people in Iraq, there are so many other questions, and many of them coming from international criminal tribunals that we've watched over the last 10 years. We'll talk a bit more about that as we look at Saddam Hussein's appearance before the Iraqi Special Tribunal today in Baghdad. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is the Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. The telephone number to join us this hour, 1-800-423-8255, on the day that Saddam Hussein answers charges before the Iraqi Special Tribunal in Baghdad. One of the ironies of putting a program like this on the air is that we're actually able to get a live phone line all the way through to Baghdad to find out what's going on there. But maintaining a connection with the capital city of the United States has been difficult. Neil Kritz is joining us now on the telephone from Washington, D.C. Hello, Neil. Please accept my apologies for the problems we've
That's
had.
All right.
A couple of the things have come and gone that I wanted to hear you weigh in on, and principal among them is just how much can be learned, has been learned, from the International Criminal Tribunal in Yugoslavia, in East Timor, in where else, Sierra Leone, places like this, in setting this up. Because I know that your involvement with those has been considerable. In fact, there's been conferences and papers written about what can be learned. I mean, if we look simply at Yugoslavia, one of the things that was pointed out was there was terrible outreach done when that International Criminal Tribunal was set up. People in Yugoslavia weren't made a part of it, though the rest of the world was, and that was thought to be a failure. Is that being addressed this time around in terms of saying, gosh, we've got to make sure that we've got credibility in Iraq?
Well, in fact, it has been identified as a key issue. One of the things that, by the way, I should note from the little bits of the conversation I heard earlier is this notion of expanding the international participation and assistance to the Iraqi tribunal. Mm-hmm. This also needs to be put into a broader context, quite frankly, because the international community over a number of years has been moving in a particular direction. And with the establishment of the International Criminal Court in The Hague, notwithstanding the U.S. government's current opposition to it, the rest of the international community has been moving toward creation of a new framework. The basis of that framework is that in cases like these, it's always best to have a local process of justice, and you only create an international institution outside the country when nothing else is possible. So the international community, if it believes in this, really needs to engage. The Iraqis have been increasingly eager and interested in reaching out to learn the lessons from these other tribunals. There was a meeting organized only a couple of months back that brought together the key Iraqis involved in establishment of the special tribunal with key people, officials, and others involved in specifically the tribunals you're talking about, the International Tribunal for Yugoslavia, the International Tribunal for Rwanda, the tribunals that have been set up for East Timor and Sierra Leone, et cetera, specifically to try to glean the lessons. And on this issue of outreach, this was a prime concern. In the case of these international tribunals, even questions of language, namely documents of the tribunals would be translated into international languages, into English and French, for example, but not into Bosnian for people on the ground, the primary audience to actually get access to. In the case of the Iraqi tribunal, there is a premium that is going to be placed on ensuring that the Iraqi public has access either directly through the courtroom, keeping in mind the security challenges that will be faced, as well as outreach and ensuring that the entire Iraqi public through a variety of media has an opportunity to really be engaged in and follow
But at some point, Neil, somebody has to make a judgment that the Iraqi court system, the Iraqi judicial system, the Iraqi judges, the investigators, all those people are capable of conducting a tribunal like this, even with all the sorts of international involvement and assistance that's there. You know, we've heard earlier on the program that it's a judicial system that was in many ways crushed and twisted and bent all out of shape during the years of the 35 years of the Ba'ath Party. So is it asking too much of them to say, no, you go ahead, you run this?
Well, to say, you go ahead, you run it, we'll abandon you and do it on your own, I think is asking too much. To say that one can find within the Iraqi system enough qualified professional judges and investigators and others and work with them and provide them advice and assistance and training in areas where they need it and to assist them in this process, I don't think is asking too much or being unrealistic. Interestingly enough, at least in some surveys, an overwhelming majority of Iraqis, notwithstanding the years of the regime, feel similarly. There have already been at least two rounds of de-Ba'athification, of purging of the Iraqi judiciary based on suspicion of judges being tainted for their participation in the regime abuses, et cetera. And a significant number of judges have been found to still qualify to remain on the bench.
Okay, I want to get back to our callers, but just a quick point of clarification. My understanding is that of the judges who have been chosen for the special tribunal, none of their names have been published. They're too concerned about their own safety to have their name published. To me, that's kind of a red flag about whether or not the system can be trusted if the judges sitting up there remain, you know, sort of hooded, nameless.
I fully expect that will have to change as this tribunal proceeds. Initially, there are these security concerns, but obviously, if this is going to be a fair and open process, if there is going to be due process, it cannot proceed as a star chamber, but in fact, this will need to be much more public, including, obviously, things like the identity of the judges.
All right. 1-800-423-8255, the number to join us. Next to Boston, Catherine's on the line. Hi, Catherine. Thank you for calling.
Hi, how are you?
Fine.
I want to comment on the inability to use the death penalty if the trial is internationalized. by bringing our attention to the criminal proceedings occurring in reference to the Rwandan genocide.
Mm-hmm.
So there is an issue where higher-level officials involved in the genocide were tried under international law and thus not subject to the death penalty,
right,
while lower-level officials and people who weren't involved in orchestrating the genocide were tried under local law and subject to the death penalty. And so
was anybody executed there, Catherine? Are you on top of that?
I'm actually not sure about that right now. I think there's some people who are still waiting, but I'm not quite sure, so yeah. I can't really comment.
We'll check that with our guests. But I mean, this Rwanda, one of the lessons I understand, Neil Kritz, of Rwanda is that they just ended up with too many people in prison and without a tribunal able to make their way through the tens of thousands of people who are even today locked up.
Well, actually, and it relates to Imad's comment at the early part of the program with respect to a desire to ensure that everyone in Iraq that, is in any way affiliated with regime abuses should be put on trial and held accountable. I think Rwanda is the lesson for this issue. Rwandans admirably wanted to get rid of a culture of impunity and establish one of accountability after the genocide. But before they knew it, they had 125,000 people stuffed into prisons that were built to hold a small percentage of that.
Mm-hmm.
And it would have taken at one point, the calculation was 400 years to process the caseload. Clearly, in the case of Iraq, there needs to be a decision as to how wide to cast the net, and that will be an ongoing subject of debate, I suspect, for some time. It obviously will be more than just these 12 individuals. Numbers have suggested somewhere in the range of a few hundred cases potentially over the next few years to be brought before this tribunal. That will be a significant challenge in and of itself. And again, that's one of the lessons that emerges from the tribunals that have been established elsewhere.
Okay. Hani Magali.
Death penalty, if I could just respond to the caller. In Rwanda, in fact, they did provide for the death penalty in the lower-level cases, the national trials. Initially, 22 individuals were executed out of the over 7,000 genocide cases that have been processed by the Rwandan courts, and then they stopped. There was one initial round of execution. The death penalty has not been carried out since then.
Okay, Catherine, I hope that answers your question. Hani Magali, just a quick one from you on this. I mean, if I go back to where we were talking with Imad at the very beginning of the program,
right,
he seemed to be indicating that he wants the Iraqi Special Tribunal to be able to look at people who are currently a part of the interim government. And my understanding is that that would be somewhat difficult right now because they've sort of set themselves the calendar parameters of the period of time that the Ba'ath Party was in power and no other time.
Right. I mean, one of the things that should be happening now in Iraq is some entity, somebody, whether it's coming from the Iraqi government that's now in place or maybe a mixed commission that would include international experts and Iraqis, should really look at the whole landscape so that the tribunal fits into an overall plan rather than it's dealt with separately and
right.
Reparations are dealt with separately and the mass graves are dealt with separately, etc. So that they could be saying, look, here in Iraq we have, you know, we're dealing with past abuses. This will involve prosecutions. This will involve vetting. This will involve reparations. This will involve maybe a process of truth-telling, a truth commission of sorts. This will involve dealing with the mass graves both for prosecution purposes but also as a humanitarian issue for the families who are looking for their missing loved ones. And these, all these processes should be working together, strengthening each other. At the moment, we're seeing that they're actually working often in competition with each other. You know, do you give priority to on the mass graves to the prosecutions, or do you give it to finding the missing loved ones and helping the families come to terms with what's happened?
Right, and making space for the victims to get their statements.
So all of that needs to be looked at as a whole and dealt with as part of an overall plan that's also made, you know, publicly available to Iraqis, and Iraqis have a role in being consulted and saying what they would like to happen.
Okay, let me go back to our our callers, to Raleigh, North Carolina, and Mike's with us next. Mike, thanks for calling.
Thank you. I was wondering if your guest could explain how judges and lawyers can be deemed competent when they spent 30 years being complacent.
I wonder if it's even fair, Mike, to talk about them as being complacent. I know when I was in Baghdad, I met judges who, the judges I met who were not complacent were thrown in jail. Some of them were killed.
Exactly. And you said we've purged the Ba'athist sympathizers. And I think now when these judicial officials stick their head up, I think they're going to be purged by the bad guys.
The question works no matter how you look at it, Neil Kritz. Either the judges that we're talking about in Baghdad, you know, kept their heads down during the time of the Saddam regime, or they opposed it and were punished for that. So they're either complicit or they have a history of opposition. Who gets to be, who's fair in a situation like that?
In a situation like the one that you're dealing with, the bottom line is you're never going to have a pristine, perfect solution. And you have to decide on what the best approach is to best achieve justice for the victims and for the entire society. Within Iraq, the challenge is to find those judges. And as you point out, there were many courageous judges who believed in the independence of the judiciary, who believed in the rule of law. And in some cases, those judges were punished as a result. In some cases, those judges fled the country, mm-hmm. And then some and are returning. There are judges also who simply manage to stay above it, to manage to stay outside of the abuses of the regime, who are regarded, as professional. And it will be a matter of identifying. You have to keep in mind, out of a system that involved hundreds of judges throughout the country, you don't need to find that many in order to establish a credible panel for this tribunal.
So you think they can do it, Neil?
Yes. I think it'll be a challenge. I think it will be require a lot of work. I think it will require a lot of assistance. But I think, A, I think that they can do it. B, I believe that if we outside the country really believe in a process of justice for Iraqi victims, we're obliged to help them try it.
Hani, quick last one from you. Can this work?
I think it would certainly help if the assistance that's being provided to them is much more internationalized rather than coming through the CPA or through the United States only. It's an open question, really, whether with training you can bring, people who have really very little experience in these types of tribunals up to the level where they will be adjudicating, making very difficult decisions based on very complex evidence, looking at issues like intent when you're talking about genocide, etc. But certainly if they could be helped with the best international expertise, we can have a good shot at it.
Hani, I have to stop you there. We are out of time. I want to thank you both for persevering with us through some of our technical hiccups. I'm sure that we'll be talking about this again. I'd like to have you both back. Neil Kritz, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Neil is director of the Rule of Law Program at the United States Institute of Peace. And Hani Magali, again, thanks for your help.
Thank you.
Hani is director of the Middle East Program at the International Center for Transitional Justice. Earlier in the program, we heard from Thanasi Kambanis, a correspondent for the Boston Globe based in Iraq, and Imad joining us from Baghdad. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.